It is April 26, 2022. I am Louise Bjorkman. I am joined this morning by Chief Judge Siegel and Judge Bratfold. This is the second case on our calendar for oral argument this morning. It is the matter of Asha Ahmed versus Nicollet County Health and Human Services and Jody Harpstead, Commissioner of Human Services. As our assistant just indicated, I understand the respondents will be splitting their time equally, and so we are prepared for that. The only other thing I would remind you is to please state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument, and also remind everyone who is observing that there is no recording of this session permitted by our rules. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Nicole Morgos of Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, representing Asha Ahmed, the appellant in this matter. This case is about intent. It is about what Asha Ahmed understood, believed, and intended concerning work after she applied for benefits with the agency. A recording of the administrative disqualification hearing testimony does not exist, so a transcript cannot be created. This record is before the court without a transcript of the hearing and without a transcript of Ms. Ahmed's interview with the fraud investigator that occurred during the investigation. Due to the lack of a transcript, the commissioner cannot meet the burden of proof that Ms. Ahmed committed an intentional program violation. And this court cannot affirm the decision to disqualify Ms. Ahmed from receiving benefits for 1 year with a crucial piece of the record missing. Ms. Ahmed speaks Somali. She does not speak or read English. She also does not read in Somali. What is missing in this case are her words. Her words to show that she did not intend to defraud the agency.
Can I interrupt just for a minute? So where in your filings with the district court and with this court is a statement of the facts that you're claiming were incorrectly decided? I mean, I understand that the inferences from the commissioner's human service judge's decision are being contested. What did the judge get wrong, I guess, and where do we find that in your briefing? Because I understand the concern about not having a record, and it's a legitimate, very valid concern.
So the judge in the district court determined that based on the written record alone, there was enough evidence to affirm the human service judge's decision to disqualify Ms. Ahmed from receiving benefits for 1 year. Essentially, the judge said that the lack of a transcript didn't change that decision. However, missing the transcript, we are missing out on Ms. Ahmed's words. And the purpose of the intentional program violation is to show what Ms. Ahmed intended, not simply that something wasn't reported or that there was some mistake that was made. There has to be an intent to actually defraud and receive benefits by purposely not providing that information.
Counsel, if I can just follow up briefly, as I am also troubled by the lack of a transcript here, in light of the statutory requirement to make a recording of these proceedings. But I also don't hear you as contesting errors, saying that there are errors in the findings of fact, lacking of substantial evidence. You definitely challenge the inference of intent. I get that. So I want you to understand, I recognize that. But now the argument you just made, so what did Ms. Ahmed intend? What did she know? Did she not understand the forms that she was responding to, or was there some miscommunication? So I don't see any findings of fact that would suggest that she doesn't understand the forms. So are you suggesting that when the district court, when the HRJ summarized the evidence of Ms. Ahmed's testimony, that she said something in her testimony that was not captured in the factual findings?
Judge, I would say that goes to, especially when we're talking about in the record, the offer letter. So the offer letter for her employment, and there from my recollection, there was testimony from Ms. Ahmed about not understanding what that form said. And if we had the transcript of the hearing or the recording of the hearing so that we could make a transcript, we would be able to have that testimony.
Well, let's just take that example, because you're right. I mean, there are many steps here, right, in the record. And let's just take the offer letter. And you're right, I definitely remember the HSJ summarizing, the human services judge summarizing Ms. Ahmed's testimony about the offer letter and her failure to understand. And it goes much beyond that, right? Because it isn't just the offer letter. We're talking about the application form itself and the no answer on the application form and Ms. Ahmed's testimony that she knew she had to be truthful about whether she was employed or not. And that she knew that she had in fact signed a letter asking her to show up at an employer on a specific day and time. She understood that. She knew she had an obligation to update the county with information about any employment or any income. She's been receiving public assistance for a number of years. So we have many findings, is what I'm trying to say, not give all of them here, but we have many findings by the human services judge that create this sort of, you know, chain of facts from which an inference was ultimately drawn by the HSJ that Ms. Ahmed understood what she was responding to. Did she in fact also say she didn't understand? Sure, but that's a weight of the evidence. And I don't think that an HSJ is bound by any particular piece of testimony. So help me understand how you're asking us to review this, given, again, our review at administrative decisions, you know, is fairly clearly circumscribed.
So what we're looking at here is whether there is substantial evidence of intent here. And although the HSJ had made some findings in the hearing, neither the district court or this court can do a full review of the record without having the audio recording, without being able to have a transcript. So that there is the HSJ's decision. There's, you know, the 500-ish pages of written materials that was provided to the district court. But from my recollection, I think the hearing was 4 or 5 hours long. So we're missing that testimony from Ms. Ahmed for the court to be able to do.
You just have to help me out, counsel. What testimony are we missing? Because we have a summary. And I don't minimize the failure here. You know, there's a statutory requirement to record those proceedings. So I take that very seriously. On the other hand, I don't see where our review is hampered unless you were to suggest to us that the HSJ omitted, you know, crucial testimony. And then I'm listening. But again, we have an argument and a pretty persuasive one under our rules of appellate procedure that there is a mechanism for you to address omissions as well. And you didn't do that. You know, a statement of the proceedings is what I'm referring to.
I would, for the statement of proceedings, this situation is different since, like you had mentioned earlier, Judge, there is a requirement under the rules that the human services judge and, you know, ensure that the recording equipment is working properly so that an adequate record can be made. That same sort of rule isn't present in other proceedings. And regarding making a statement, it's something that can be done. However, trying to recreate Ms. Ahmed's testimony from a hearing that occurred in March of 2020 is something that is not easy to do, particularly due to the amount of time that the hearing took and the amount of testimony that occurred.
Is there any case law that would suggest, I think what you're arguing, that is the only remedy for the failure to make the required recording would be to reverse the determination, the disqualification determination? What case law would say that is the appropriate remedy?
So the Hernandez case. Oh, sorry. So regarding a reversing for a lack of a transcript, I don't know that there's any. case law for that specifically. There have been some cases where they say that a lack of a transcript doesn't allow the court to review the case. However, in those cases, we're not talking about an administrative disqualification hearing with a statute that requires the agency to provide the transcript. And instead, Ms. Ahmed is being essentially required or told that she should have supplemented the record.
So to be clear, counsel, I am not suggesting that you Ms. Ahmed had the duty to provide a recording or to somehow recreate a transcript. What I am asking you to specifically address is whether there were omissions or blatant mischaracterizations of the evidence in the human services judge's findings of fact about the testimony. You keep going to Ms. Ahmed's testimony, so I've limited it to that. But, without a specific argument from you that claims that there was an omission or a mischaracterization, I just don't see where we go with your argument about a lack of a recording and a transcript. Seems to me we rely on the HSJ summary of the testimony and examine it for in light of the arguments that you make.
So we would of course disagree with the HSJ's characterization of the testimony and what she understood to be true and what she didn't, understand to be true. And of course, having the lack of a record, we're not able to hear how she answered questions, her tone, her cadence, and that's missing here. We are not able to hear what her exact words are and can only rely on the judge's, the judge's summary of what those words are.
But isn't that exactly what the district court, sitting as a review court and now us, have to defer to the fact finder's determination of kind of credibility? I mean, the fact finder the human services judge did not believe your client, saying she really didn't understand this. It's reflected in the findings that she testified about that. So what allows us then to reweigh? Because it seems like your argument now is, well, you don't get the tone, you don't get the exact words, and that could make a difference. But doesn't that just go to the human services judge's conclusions or inferences drawn that this was intentional? And I've talked long enough, but how can we go in and reweigh that? And why?
So looking at the Hazleton case, in Hazleton, they did exactly that. They noted the burden of proof, or what they were looking at was substantial evidence of intent. And that case came to them, a similar, also an intentional program violation case, so an administrative disqualification hearing. And in that case, they were able to, they essentially reversed and said, no, there was not substantial evidence of intent that the recipient of benefits in that case had intentionally lied or was false or misleading in that case. So in that case, in Hazleton, they were able to look at the evidence again and determine that no, an intentional program violation was not proven. And not only are we looking at, I know we've been discussing the transcript a lot, but the other part of our argument concerns the amount of time that the judge, the human services judge, has to make a decision, which is both a federal regulation and adopted by the state of Minnesota, that the decision to disqualify Ms. Ahmed from receiving benefits was made too late. The federal
how did that delay prejudice your client?
So I would say that Ms. Ahmed was prejudiced by having to wait for this, decision, by having to have this sort of hanging over our head. And looking at the statute, it's unambiguous. Shall means shall. And therefore, there's no need to even look at prejudice or look at any other statutory interpretation when the reading of the statute on its face, it is unambiguous. It has a common and ordinary meaning. Furthermore,
Council, just to go back to prejudice for just a moment, because I think I did, you know, you well briefed your statutory argument. Ms. Ahmed continued to receive benefits, right, until the final decision by the commissioner. Is that right?
That is correct, Judge.
Okay. And did she have to repay? I didn't see any reference to that.
No, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right, counsel, your time has expired. You will have an opportunity for a rebuttal argument. We will next hear from Mr. Dietrich. And
thank you, Your Honor.
First half of the respondent's argument. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is RJ Dietrich, and I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent commissioner of human services. Your Honors, the commissioner certainly appreciates the importance of issuing timely decisions and of proving a record for appeal. But in this case, the fact of the matter is that appellant was not substantially prejudiced by the delay in the commissioner's decision or the lack of a transcript. And so those issues do not allow for reversal here. Now, under the Fair Hearing Statute and federal regulation, a decision is supposed to be issued by the commissioner within 90 days of the request for a disqualification hearing. But there's no consequence for noncompliance listed in federal or state law. And the law is clear that when a statute lists a timing provision like that, but does not list a consequence for noncompliance, the statute is considered directory and not mandatory. And that means that the court...
No, and I understand, and you've laid it out well in your brief, but I mean, the fact that even if we agree with you that this is a directory statute, I mean, a 297-day delay doesn't mean automatically the decision must be reversed, but certainly prejudice comes in to play, and a court would have a reason to wonder and think that perhaps the action taken should be reversed.
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly the court can consider prejudice. And if an individual shows that they were subject to substantial prejudice as a result of delay, that certainly is grounds for reversal. But here, we just don't have that substantial prejudice. While the hearing, while the decision was delayed, the hearing itself was not delayed. The hearing was held less than, 60 days, well within the 90 days and even less than 60 days from the date of that request for a disqualification hearing. So there wasn't a risk of evidence being lost or memories fading. And appellant had a full and fair opportunity to present evidence to challenge the county's evidence. In addition, as appellant said in her appellant's attorney said in her argument, the appellant continued to receive benefits during the pendency of the commissioner's decision. And the cases that appellant cites in urging the court to reverse based on the delay, Blue and Hernandez simply are not on facts analogous to those that we have here. In Blue, you have...
Oh, I'm sorry. Finish. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, in Blue, you had a Minnesota Department of Human Rights decision that was delayed by, it took over 31 months for the commissioner, the Department of Human Rights, to just issue a probable cause determination, not even a final decision. And in Hernandez, you had, it was dealing with the same fair hearing statute, but the I apologize, Your Honor. But the decision was issued 2 years after the request for a hearing, and the hearing itself was delayed 120 days. Also, in that case, the individual was disqualified from working in her chosen field during that entire period. Here, the hearing itself was not delayed. The delay in the decision was much shorter than in either Bilal or Hernandez. It was about 7 months beyond the 90 days and a little over a year from the date that appellant actually submitted her application for benefits that the commissioner's decision came out. And again, appellant received benefits throughout the pendency of the commissioner's decision. So that substantial prejudice just isn't there here.
So I was just going to ask a quick question about, so the penalty, the 1 year disqualification started after the final, the amended determination. I mean, what if that was a worse time? I mean, these benefits are not just for appellant here. She's got kids. We're talking about food assistance for kids. So is that a form of prejudice? I mean, this delay in the disqualification period, maybe she's lost her job and she was better able to manage this disqualification period earlier on. I don't know.
Your Honor, there's nothing indicating that in the record, certainly. So I don't believe that is. And I would say that I believe that the disqualification would be particular to her. So there's a chance that it wouldn't even affect, you know, potential children in the home. As to the lack of a transcript here, well, you know, obviously, Ms. Ahmed bears no, you know, responsibility for the issue with a transcript being unavailable. It's my understanding that there was a technical glitch that resulted in that. But it is Ms. Ahmed's obligation on appeal to the court to present the court with a record to allow this court to review what she's asking to be reviewed. And appellant, if Ms. Ahmed believed that there was testimony that's not accurately reflected in the commissioner's order or is otherwise missing from the record here, she did have multiple opportunities to supplement the record. Not only did she have an opportunity to submit a statement under Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure, Civil Appellate Procedure 110.03 to this court, but under Minnesota Statute 256.045, she also had the opportunity to ask the district court to accept additional evidence if she wanted to put that into the record, and she did not do that. So as with the 90-day issue, the lack of the transcript simply, she has not shown any prejudice, and she also has not indicated, you know, what evidence missing from the record could somehow change the outcome here. And I would also point the court to her closing argument submitted after the fair hearing, where she doesn't take issue with the fact that she worked, you know, at the occasions group on a particular day and the various conversations that she had with the county worker. And I see that I'm out of time. So with that, I would just ask that the court affirm the commissioner's order in full. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Coriel?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Megan Gaudette Coriel. I'm an assistant Nicollet County attorney, and I represent respondent Nicollet County Health and Human Services. I intend to focus my portion of oral argument on whether the record contains substantial evidence to support the commissioner's decision that appellant committed an intentional program violation. Even without a transcript, there is substantial evidence in the record to support the commissioner's decision. As a brief note, I would like to address the standard of review. While appellant contends that the standard of review on appeal is clear and convincing evidence, that is the standard of review for hearings before the human services judge. This court's scope of review is directed by Minnesota Statute 1469.
So, counsel, in addressing the findings regarding intent. Of course, that is an element here and was found. Would you focus on the argument that was raised by appellant's counsel about the, I think it's the Hazleton decision, and the comparisons that appellant makes between that case and this one?
In Hazleton, it's my understanding that the court did reverse the finding of intentional program violation. Essentially, the court found that the appellant in that matter was not misleading because of the forms in that matter. The court found the forms could have been confusing. So there's a reporting period every so often an applicant or recipient of public assistance needs to update or report changes. And the form in that, while it was intended to be for the entire reporting period, it stated, I believe, the month of June, and whether or not someone had moved into or out of the residence for the report month, and then in parentheses, there was an S. And so appellant's son hadn't moved in. It's my recollection that in that case, her son hadn't moved in or out of the residence in that month. And I believe that this case is different. There was a direct conversation between Ms. Ahmed and the eligibility worker in this case the day after Ms. Ahmed had attended her first shift at the occasions group. She had worked the night before, so November 11th. She spoke with the eligibility worker on November 12th and said she was going to be attending orientation that day, meaning November 12th of 2019.
Ms. Ahmed's testimony, as summarized by the human services judge, indicates that she believed that she was attending orientation and that there was at most a temporary job, and she did not know more than that. And so in light of that, is this case similar to Hazleton, and that what we have is confusion on Ms. Ahmed's part as to what was being asked and to how her answers would be interpreted? And I'm focusing particularly, as you just did, on that follow-up interview on November 12th.
I do not believe that there was confusion. The offer letter from the occasions group stated Ms. Ahmed's schedule. It stated her supervisor's name. It stated the date and time of orientation, and it also stated that was the date and time of her first shift. That does lead me to a point of clarification I did want to make. On page 27, my brief states that Mr. Anderson, he is in HR at the occasions group, advised that interpreters for Somali-speaking workers were available when employment was offered. The email had indicated that interpreters were available for Somali-speaking workers, but there was no way to tell if an interpreter was used during the interview. The email did go on to state that it was clear from the employee information paperwork, so the I-9, W-4, and employee contact information, that Ms. Ahmed did have someone assisting her. I believe that this case is different. Again, the offer letter stated at the bottom, essentially indicating that by signing, you are accepting an offer of employment. Again, it did have...
Make it clear that it's full-time employment? I mean, temporary, I don't know, it seems like it's some kind of food service job. Can be very occasional, and so I, you know, that, and that might support her her confusion. So is there something saying, yes, this is full time and here's when you're showing up? Or, and maybe I missed it in the record and reading through the record.
The offer letter is contained in the multiple pages that were submitted. There is specific dates and shifts stated, so I can't remember. It was multiple right, shifts during the week.
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
And so I would also like to point out that even if the assertion, even if this court does accept the assertion that Ms. Ahmed did not understand the offer letter, the written offer letter, she was asked a direct question by the eligibility worker on November 12th and provided a misleading answer. And in those contexts, hello? I think my screen froze.
I can still hear you.
Okay, I'm sorry. My screen froze. I wanted to make sure.
Yeah, no, we can hear you and see you. Yeah.
My apologies. So an interpreter was used with contacts with the eligibility worker. And so, again, as the commissioner pointed out, there's nothing in the record that indicates that appellant or Ms. Ahmed misunderstood what was being asked of her. So in response to a question from the eligibility worker on November 12th, again, the day after appellant had worked her first shift and attended orientation, Ms. Ahmed provided misleading information, stated she hadn't worked. The offer letter did state that she...
Then let me just back up for a second. I guess it's my understanding that even if it was temporary employment, she was under an obligation to disclose it. Is that correct?
I would submit that yes, she was. She was going to be paid even if she had only attended that orientation shift. The offer letter states that she would be paid for that. Ms. Ahmed was aware that the amount, or that if she had employment that could affect her eligibility for or the amount of benefits she did receive. And so I believe that is employment of any form should have been reported. And I see my time is running short. So in conclusion, I would submit that the commissioner did have jurisdiction to render the decision. Ms. Ahmed did receive a fair opportunity for judicial review despite the lack of transcript. The existing record does contain substantial evidence to support the commissioner's decision that Ms. Ahmed did commit an intentional program violation, and therefore I would request that this court affirm the decision of the commissioner. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Morgos, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You are still muted. Happens all the time.
And I swore I wouldn't be that person. May it please the court. Nicole Morgos from Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, representing appellant Asha Ahmed. I do want to respond to something counsel Detrick had brought up concerning the benefits in response to a question from Judge Siegel. So when someone is disqualified from receiving benefits, the remaining persons in the household can continue to receive benefits, although the amount is lessened. So Ms. Ahmed cannot, her income is considered part of the household, but she cannot be considered an additional household member to receive a higher benefit amount. So the benefit amount is reduced after a disqualification occurs. And I want to also go back to the Hazleton decision and say that there was, you know, confusion in that case, and there was also confusion in this case, especially concerning Ms. Ahmed is a person who has limited English proficiency, and she does not speak English, does not read in English, and all of the documents that we're talking about in the administrative record are all written in English that she has to try to understand. And furthermore, I want to note that this type of case is different. In most human services appeals, the appellant has to file an appeal. They disagree with something, they have to file an appeal. The administrative disqualification hearing is treated more like a quasi criminal proceeding, as the person has to actually opt out of the appeal, so waive their right to any hearing and either admit to the facts or not admit to the facts. But if they don't do anything, then an appeal is automatically scheduled. And furthermore, we're looking at a higher burden of proof as well. There was mention of the Hernandez case, although that was a case that concerned a maltreatment determination, which has a different burden of proof. Those are cases that are determined by a preponderance of the evidence. And in that case, when they were looking at the 90-day deadline, they were only looking at the state statute. For administrative disqualification hearings, it automatically adopts the federal regulation of the 90-day, which is in contrast to Hernandez that only looked at the state statute.
Is it fair to say that case law recognizes a distinction between mandatory and directory statutes, both with respect to federal legislation and state statutes?
So the respondents had mentioned some different cases where the court determined that a statute was directory as opposed to mandatory. I will note those cases did not concern an intentional program violation or an administrative disqualification hearing. Those were land use cases about zoning and eminent domain. So those were different sorts of cases than we are looking at here. And in looking at the federal cases, they are looking at federal regulations, federal codes, which we are also looking at in this case. And the Supreme Court did, the United States Supreme Court did note a distinction between using the words shall and may, which the federal regulation uses both those words throughout the entire regulation. The Supreme Court has said, well, if we're going to use both of those words, then the shall should be read as mandatory if also may is being used. And again, going back to that, that these administrative disqualification hearings require someone to opt out as opposed to opting in, the commissioner did not fulfill the procedural requirements by making the decision within 90 days as required by the federal regulation, which was adopted by Minnesota statute, and then compounded that error by failing to produce an audio recording so that a transcript could be created. And on these facts, they shouldn't get a do-over. Ms. Ahmed shouldn't be required to have to go through this again, especially when we're talking about events that occurred in October and November of 2019. So we're getting closer to 3 years on here. A do-over would prejudice Ms. Ahmed and cause her harm now. It should be reversed on unlawful procedure as the commissioner exceeded her authority to make a decision in this case and additionally did not provide a audio recording for a transcript as required. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you all for your helpful arguments. We'll